Good evening, everybody, and welcome to this webinar presented by Emerging Minds and the Mental Health Practitioners Network. Tonight's webinar is on the working to support children and families living with fetal alcohol spectrum. We're really pleased to be bringing you this webinar tonight, and we welcome the almost 500 of you who are joining us so far to tonight's webinar and the viewers who are watching this via the podcast. MHPN wishes to acknowledge, as well as Emerging Minds, the traditional custodians of the lands across Australia upon which our webinar presenters and participants are located. We wish to pay respect to the elders past, present and future, for the memories, the traditions, the cultures and hopes of Indigenous Australians. So my name's Dan Moss, and I'm the Workforce Development Manager here at Emerging Minds. And as I said, I'm really thrilled to be bringing this webinar for you tonight. We've got some great presenters and really interesting content to bring to you tonight. So this is the second webinar in the second series of the Child and Infant Mental Health webinar series presented, as I said, by Emerging Minds and the Mental Health Professionals Network. Upcoming webinars in this series are working to support the mental health of children with an intellectual disability, supporting trans and gender diverse children and their families, Aboriginal children and the effects of intergenerational trauma, and engaging children and parents affected by child and sexual abuse. So to subscribe to receive your information around these webinars, please visit us on www.emergingminds.com.au/subscribe. So just remember, for those of you joining us who have joined us for a long time, that we do have a new platform which you'll notice tonight. Most of the navigation buttons on these platforms are located at the top right of your screen. So to access the chat box, click on the purple button. If you have a question, please use the blue button. Slides and resources are available from the light blue download button. And there is a help button. So if you need assistance, please, you can message Rep Back directly or ring 1-800-733-4166. So also please, after tonight's webinar, we really encourage you to open and fill in the survey and feedback form to let us know what you enjoyed or what could be improved from tonight's webinar. Okay, so we've got a couple of learning outcomes for you tonight, which we're really pleased to be starting the conversation about this really challenging issue. So after tonight's webinar, we're really hoping that you'll be able to describe how fetal alcohol syndrome disorder, or FASD, affects children and families across their lifespan. We're hoping that you'll be able to describe best practice and referral processes for children and families living with FASD. We're hoping that you'll be able to identify the relationships between social, community and service factors for children and families living with FASD. So without any further ado, I'm really pleased to be able to introduce tonight's panel. And firstly, I'd like to introduce Professor Elizabeth Elliott, AM. Professor Elizabeth Elliott has had a long history, both as a paediatrician, as an academic, working with the NHMRC Practitioner Fellowship and the NHMRC Centre for Research Excellent, and she's affiliated with Uni of Sydney, Sydney Children's Hospital Network. So for those of you who know about FASD, it's most likely that you all have listened to or read lots of the material which Liz has produced in her time. And Liz, thanks so much for joining us tonight. You've been
Pleasure,
a lead
Dan.
Expert in FASD for many years. So can you tell us, in that time, what are the significant advances in the diagnoses and the treatment of children with FASD?
Well, look, I think the most significant advance with regard to health professionals is that we've raised the level of awareness. So they're now more aware of the potential harms of alcohol use in pregnancy and what fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is. And we've provided that information through various resources such as the FASD Hub Australia and through the NoFASD website. Also, we've produced the Australian Guide to the Diagnosis, which just steps health professionals through how to make a diagnosis. So even if they don't have to make the diagnosis, they understand the process. With regard to treatment, I guess we realise that there are no specific treatments evident from randomised trials that help particularly relevant to fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. But we know it's important, therefore, to assess children and to treat their needs, whether they be through speech therapy, physio or whatever. And also we've got very many useful practical tips from parents and psychologists and others to help us assist these children and families.
Thank you so much, Liz. Our next panellist tonight is Dr. Sarah McLean, who's a psychologist and researcher and currently working in South Australia at Emerging Minds, and the author of various publications which Emerging Minds has recently produced around this topic. Sarah, welcome. As a psychologist, what do you think are the most important aspects of working with mothers whose children experience FASD?
Well, I hope it would go without saying that we strive to adopt a no-blame approach to mums who have consumed alcohol during pregnancy. I think it can be useful to really make do some deep reflection around the difference between behaviour and intentions. And it's very, I think, rare for a woman to have the intention to harm her baby by drinking alcohol during pregnancy, but rather that alcohol consumption reflects a whole range of social and psychological pressures, as well as awareness of alcohol consumption. But alcohol consumption can reflect difficulties in coping, psychosocial stresses, that can reflect aspects of their relationship with their partner and their partner's relationship with alcohol. So there are a lot of complexity or social determinants of drinking that I think it's really important to be mindful of and to really make that distinction between intentional behaviour and behaviour that's not intended to harm, because I think that opens up then the dialogue to focus on the good intentions of a parent and then to move forward in terms of strategies that might help.
Yeah, thank you for that, Sarah, and look forward to your presentation later tonight. Our next presenter tonight is Sue Myers, AM, and Sue has been a passionate advocate for children and supporter of children with FASD over a great many years. Sue, really great to have you here tonight. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Dan.
And I wonder if you could provide us with just a brief background of your experiences caring for a child with FASD.
Okay, well, our journey is quite a long one. It began 37 years ago when a 21-month-old little toddler joined our family as a foster care placement. I already had three older children and I sort of considered myself a reasonably experienced parent, but even in those really early days, we noticed behaviour that was very different and wasn't responding to our parenting. She was a very bright and active child, but she wasn't learning from her mistakes and we didn't think it was deliberate. She had very little fear. Daily meltdowns were common. We didn't realise why. And she had very little concept of stranger danger, no matter how many times we, you know, went through those issues with her. We knew she'd experienced alcohol withdrawal at birth, but there'd never been any suggestion from anyone that we'd spoken to that this may have caused any harm. When she was 10, I read an article in a magazine about fetal alcohol syndrome, and it was like reading about our daughter. But at that stage, I couldn't find any really useful information in Australia. And it wasn't until I attended a conference in Canada 20 years ago, and she was diagnosed by one of their leading paediatricians, that I finally understood the impact that prenatal exposure had on her developing brain and how this affected her development and her behaviour, and that if she was going to reach her full potential, there were a lot of things we needed to start doing differently.
Thanks for that, Sue, and thanks again for joining us tonight. We look forward to hearing from you a little bit later. So tonight, as you will all know, we're going to share some observations and some thoughts about Johnny, who's our 9-year-old case study, a boy who's facing many challenges in several aspects of his life, and possibly and probably due to exposure to alcohol in the womb. So without any further ado, I'd first like to invite Professor Elizabeth Elliott to share her observations. Liz, over to you. Liz, I think we might just have you on mute there.
Sorry. We've known for centuries that alcohol taken in pregnancy can harm the unborn child. So you might well ask, is alcohol use in pregnancy still occurring? And the answer is yes, unfortunately. We know from recent Australian studies of two pregnancy cohorts in Victoria and New South Wales that about 60% of women are drinking during pregnancy. Many of them drink before pregnancy awareness, and in this period, many of them are drinking at very risky levels. So why are we worried about this? Well, we know that alcohol readily crosses the placenta, and that alcohol is both a teratogen, it disrupts the development of the bodily organs and the brain, and a neurotoxin, that is, it can damage the developing brain and nervous systems. And one of the most severe complications of this is fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So we can describe FASD as an acquired brain injury caused by prenatal alcohol exposure. And the characteristic feature of this is not the physical features, but severe, pervasive neurodevelopmental impairment. We know, however, if there's exposure in the first trimester, this may result in the characteristic features in the face that you may be aware of, and other birth defects, and also growth failure may be present, as it was in this child, but not diagnostic. So the key thing that we see in children who don't have major congenital anomalies is that FASD presents with developmental learning and behavioural problems, and the typical time is at the age this child presented in primary school, and boys are slightly more frequently observed than girls. However, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is a lifelong disorder. It occurs throughout society. This is not a problem that's confined to disadvantaged groups or Aboriginal communities. However, there are some high-risk groups. They are siblings whose siblings have already got a diagnosis, children, obviously, whose mother have problems with alcohol dependency, children in the juvenile justice system, children in foster or adoptive care, and children in some Aboriginal communities where there's been long-term high use of alcohol. So we know that as these children grow into adolescence and adults, they continue to have problems. They have increased health and mental health problems, including problems with substance abuse. And in fact, increasingly, we're recognising that they also have a range of organic problems, problems with their cardiovascular, respiratory, immunological systems, and that these may be the result of prenatal alcohol exposure, conferring through the epigenetic mechanisms increased risk for these disorders in later life. And indeed, the American studies in adults suggest that the average age of death for people with FASD is about 34 years. As Sarah's already mentioned, it's really important that we take a strength-based approach and avoid stigma and shame, not only for the children, but for their families. So how do we make the diagnosis? Well, as with any disorder in medicine, we take a thorough history. We're interested in pregnancy, particularly prenatal alcohol exposure, but we're also interested in developmental milestones, family problems, particularly developmental problems, Fragile X and other causes of severe developmental impairment. We're interested in looking for physical abnormalities, particularly we look at facial dysmorphology, we take a head circumference, we measure and plot the height and weight against centile charts, and we look for major and minor congenital anomalies. We do a multidisciplinary assessment to look for neurodevelopmental impairment, and I'll elaborate that on just a minute. And also, we do some investigations to ensure that we're not dealing with some other cause of neurodevelopmental impairment. So, for example, in our clinic, we have the luxury of doing a chromosome microarray and excluding Fragile X in all of our children. And the other testing will be guided by the clinical setting. So, for example, a child with microcephaly may require a non-urgent MRI. Now, some of you will be familiar with these characteristic facial features. And the three cardinal features of FASD are a small palpable fissure. That's because alcohol affects the development of the optic nerve and the optic globe. And if you have a small eye, you have a smaller eye opening. And the thin upper lip, which you can observe in the top two panels of these two panels of photographs, see that thin upper lip in the top two, which is regarded as abnormal, and an indistinct philtrum. That is the area between the bottom of the nose and that upper lip. And you can see from those photographs at the bottom, in a Hispanic child, a Caucasian child, and an Afro-Caribbean child, that these features hold fast. And we know that they also hold fast in Aboriginal populations. So I mentioned the neurodevelopmental assessment, and these are the domains that we assess. We take a head circumference, we look for neurological signs and symptoms, we do an assessment for motor skills, cognition, language, academic achievement, memory, attention, executive function, including hyperactivity and impulse control. We look at affect regulation, and we look at adaptive behaviour, social skills and social communications. And you'll notice on the slide that I've asterisked some of these things, and they're the domains which the history that we've just heard about, the case study, suggest may be priorities for assessment. So finally, we make the diagnosis in two categories using the Australian guide. We talk about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder with the three central facial features, and we do that because we know that they're highly specific and sensitive for alcohol exposure in this disorder. Or conversely, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder with fewer than three facial features. And many clinicians ask us, why do we bother to make this diagnosis? Well, I think as a paediatrician, it's very important because we're often seeing children whose mothers are going to have more children, and we may be able to firstly get help for the mother for her drug and alcohol problems, and drugs often go with alcohol, but not necessarily, and we can help potentially prevent an affected sibling being born. Furthermore, early diagnosis enables early intervention, and as you all know, that increases the chance of a child reaching their potential. It also helps people change their expectations about a child, whether that be at home and at school, to understand that the way they behave, the way they perform, is a result of their brain injury, not because they're being willful. And this is very important as kids get older, that there's accommodation made for the diagnosis in the education and justice systems. A diagnosis also can help families apply for financial support, including the new NDIS support. And it's important we always refer our patients to NOFASD, who provide a fabulous service in connecting parents to each other for peer support and in providing information and a helpline for parents and families. Thank you.
Okay, my role tonight is to give a very brief overview of some of the factors involved with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder from the lens of a psychologist and psychological theory. How is fetal alcohol spectrum disorder different from other clinical or conditions of childhood that you might work with? And what can a psychologist do to better recognise and respond to fetal alcohol spectrum disorder? Looks like our slides have moved. So, Dan, would you like to move the slides, or shall I? Oh, she'll do that. Are people seeing this? Okay. Am I on track? Why are the slides moving? Okay. Great. Okay. One of the first challenges that psychologists are faced with with working with a child who's living with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, as opposed to other clinical conditions of childhood, is that fetal alcohol spectrum disorder can present in a range of ways. It can present in a variety of ways because of so many domains of development are affected, as we've heard from Elizabeth. So this presents a bit of a challenge to our conventional sort of diagnostic reasoning approach. So some of the things I really wanted to highlight that I think is important for psychologists to be aware of is that, as Elizabeth already mentioned, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder may or may not present with characteristic facial features. It may or may not present with intellectual disability. So it can be, children can present as, it can be called an invisible disorder because those characteristic facial features that we might have been trained in are not always present. As Elizabeth mentioned as well, we can think of it as a whole body condition. So increasingly we're beginning to be aware that alcohol consumption affects a whole range of body systems and developing organs in the child. So particularly visual motor coordination, visual integration, immunology, respiratory system, digestive system, and so on. And presents with high levels of comorbidity. So fetal alcohol spectrum disorder can present as very similar to ADHD, ODD, conduct disorder. And also, children who are living with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder can present with comorbid mental health conditions such as anxiety and depression. So most commonly, a child will present to your practice, their caregiver will say, my child has behaviour, social, emotional or learning issues. And while there might be social determinants of their behaviour, some aspects of their behaviour might be learnt, the big difference for fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is that many of their behavioural, social and learning issues are underpinned by difficulties with neurocognitive functioning. As Elizabeth outlined, difficulties damage the structure and function of the brain. Many of the behaviour and social learning issues are underpinned by poor working memory, poor capacity for cause and effect thinking, which we rely on in social learning paradigms or contingent learning paradigms as psychologists. Poor ability to master attentional control, particularly switching from task to task, managing the transition of attention during times of transition, and difficulties with self-regulation. So while it's common for them to present with social, emotional and learning problems, the underpinning nature of their difficulties is more based in neurocognitive functioning than social learning paradigms. So in some ways, supporting a child with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder to learn new behaviours is similar but different to the kind of conditions you might already be working with. So it can resemble intellectual disability in that a child can be slow to learn new behaviours, and you can draw on your approach to working with a child with intellectual disability in ways like deconstructing complex tasks and making them really simple, putting the steps really close together and reinforcing and shaping behaviour towards your goal. It can present as similar to a child with a specific learning difficulty in that children's cognitive profiles can be very varied. So, for example, they might have specific difficulties with visual motor integration or working memory. And so you can, similar to what you would do with a child with a learning difficulty, you would look to leverage off their strengths and then while supporting them to build the underpinning skills they need for academic success. And it's similar in some ways to the kind of approach you would take with ADHD, although it's a distinct disorder. But some of the metacognitive strategies and the impulse control strategies that you might apply to ADHD can also be used in some cases for fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, although you tend to need more parental and caregiver support to implement those strategies. So it's similar and different to some of the kind of conditions that you might be working with already. And just one thing I really wanted to emphasise was that you may use similar approaches to help children to learn new behaviour, but the behaviour that they learn or their new learning seems to fluctuate. It seems to not be a bit more difficult for them to access newly learned behaviour. And foster parents talk about this a lot in terms of the fluctuating ability, what things that they can do one day they can't do the next. And that's all anecdotal, but we haven't found a way to capture that. But you can think of it, or a foster carer explained it to me, as being like a child's learning is like the light bulb in a electrical circuit, that one day you'll flick the switch and the light bulb burns brightly. The next day you'll flick the switch and it's like as though the light bulb's on a dimmer circuit. And some days you'll flick the switch and there's no current going through whatsoever. So that's kind of a little bit different than what we might normally experience in our behavioural interventions. And very quickly, because I know Sue's going to go into this in much more detail, what are some of the principles that we think might work for supporting Johnny in the classroom? So some of the things we'd be looking to do include really that education that Elizabeth mentioned, supporting teachers and other adults around Johnny's life to understand that he's not failing or not being successful because he doesn't want to be successful or he's deliberately non-compliant, but rather that it's difficult for him to succeed at the moment the way the world is structured for him or the way the classroom is structured. So we'd also be looking to do a great analysis of the environment for him. We'd be looking to simplify the environment, free him from distractions and distracting stimuli, and we pay particular attention to the kind of behavioural triggers that are likely to be sensory in nature. And then finally, we'd be looking to favour a positive behaviour support approach over the kind of traditional contingent learning support approaches that we might normally take. We'd be looking to build up functionally equivalent skills. We'd be looking to build up his skills in social skills or in self-regulation in a very structured way, using lots of overlearning, lots of repetition, visual supports, and really leveraging off his strengths, whatever those might be. So it's really important for a psychologist to understand those strengths as well. And for this condition, more than any other, it's really important for a psychologist to be communicating really well with the adults around Johnny's life so that everybody has the same understanding about what's going on for Johnny. So I'll hand that over to you now, Sue. Thanks.
Thanks so much for that, Sarah. Really appreciate both that presentation and Liz, your presentation as well. I think you've both given us some really great both practice and academic background into the issue. So I'll now hand over to you to tell us a little bit about, certainly about your lived experience, about your relationship with your daughter for a long period of time.
Okay, so some of the issues and difficulties that Johnny's parents are experiencing will of course be related to the brain domain impairments that are identified in his FASD assessment. But to work out effective strategies, it's also important to consider these other characteristics that might be interrelating with each other and impacting on his behaviour and the behaviour that his parents and teachers are experiencing. So most children with FASD, and this can also continue into adulthood, have issues with sensory processing. So their brain has trouble really processing what they see, feel, taste, smell, and it isn't able to file them all away in the right area of the brain at the right time. So I often call it a bit like a traffic jam in the brain. So our daughter, for example, she has a lot of trouble with the inside and outside environment. So if she's inside wanting to concentrate on something, she'll actually have to close the blinds because that outside environment impinges on her too much and she just has trouble, difficulty, concentrating. Most children with FASD also are very impulsive. So they go from thought to action without the ability to draw on past experience or predict an outcome. So before they choose to do whatever it is they are thinking of doing, it just goes straight to an action. So a choice for them might not necessarily be a choice, but it's often just the first thing that comes into their mind. Perseveration is another common issue that really impacts on their behaviour sometimes. They get stuck on a thought process or an action, and this really impacts on their ability to process instructions or other information that's being presented to them at the time. This next slide is what we call a dismaturity slide. One of the biggest issues is their maturity and development can be uneven and really confusing. So irrespective of their IQ, irrespective of how well they seem to speak and present themselves, there's often varying degrees of discrepancy between their chronological age and their socio-emotional and functional development. So they often have really strong abilities in some areas. So for example, again, I'll use my daughter. She's 38. She can speak well. She presents very well. And in many ways is a typical 38-year-old. But when she interacts with her daughter, who's only 11, their socio-emotional maturity is at about the same level. And so they argue on the same level. So who goes first in a game, or who gets to choose an activity, or who gets the last piece of cake on a plate? And this can be really confusing if they seem to be able to speak very well. So when we understand these competing characteristics that and how they impact on each other, it's not surprising that what we end up is sometimes this really complex, chaotic behaviour. So luckily, there are strategies that parents have found useful for de-escalating some of this behaviour if it occurs. Of course, the best strategy is always, if possible, to be proactive and try to work out what the triggers were for that behaviour in the first place, but this is sometimes really difficult to achieve. Once a child is escalated, one of the most important things a parent can do is to try and stay calm themselves and talk quietly and use as few words as possible. Redirecting behaviour is something sometimes safer and something they can do, and try and get them to do something that's more acceptable, that's sometimes effective. But if a strategy isn't working, it's really important to stop, rethink, and think about doing something differently rather than keep trying harder on something that, isn't really working very well. The case study also mentions that Johnny is experiencing problems with memory and listening skills. And there's a saying that children with FASD are 10-second children in a 3-second world. So it's important when we're talking to these children to use shorter sentences, use fewer words, allow extra time for them to process information. And it's really important to check that they've really understood what you've said. These are very children that are very good at saying yes, they understand, but it's so important to get feedback because often they're just saying yes because they know that's what you want to hear. They're very literal thinkers, so it's important to use concrete language and minimise the use of abstract concepts. And as I mentioned earlier, many children and adults with FASD have far better expressive language than receptive, so it's really helpful at times to use different methods of sharing or translating information that they have to know. So for example, using visuals, illustrations, or role playing and role modelling can be really helpful to getting information across. It might also be helpful to break activities into small doable steps, and an effective tool that many parents use is to actually provide a picture chart of the child doing each of the steps that's required for a particular activity. This might even be necessary for seemingly simple everyday tasks, such as getting dressed or packing their school bag. So for example, a chart for packing their school bag might look like a series of photos of their child firstly putting their lunch in their lunchbox, then putting their lunchbox into their bag, then putting their school books into their bag, and then the final picture of them putting their bag onto their back. And of course, gentle reminders and prompts may also always be necessary for these children because of their memory issues. And then there's also many general accommodations and strategies that parents and carers have found that help things run more smoothly each day. And to save everyone's sanity and to avoid setting children with FASD up for failure, one of the most important strategies is to always remember to think younger, remember what really is their developmental age, and have realistic expectations that are based on their developmental age, not their chronological age. Because of their problems with memory, and often they have little concept of time, establishing structure and routine helps them make sense of their day and helps them make sense of their world, and that helps to lessen their anxiety. Modifying the physical environment helps to address their sensory issues. They do best in a low stimulus environment, and this can be achieved by using natural lighting whenever possible, soft colours on the walls, and reducing noise and visual clutter as much as possible. Tapping into their strengths is really important. This helps children and young people feel more positive about themselves, and it's a positive feelings of self-worth that can help prevent the many secondary issues that we often see down the track, such as dropping out of school early or substance misuse, unemployment or mental health concerns. And to finish, it's important to remember that although people with FASD share many similar characteristics, each person with FASD is also unique, and one size doesn't fit all. There's a saying that if you know one person with FASD, then all you really do know is one person with FASD. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Sue, and for sharing your really personal experiences with us and to all our panellists. I think the 600 of you out there who are listening will agree that they've been really informative and interesting presentations. So thank you to all of you. So we've got some really great questions coming in from our audience already. And Liz, I thought I might start with you and throw you a few questions without notice, if that's okay, because they are so great. So Sheila asks a question which touched a little bit on your presentation. Her question was, is it common for children to be diagnosed with ASD when perhaps it might be FASD that they're experiencing?
Yes, look, that's a very good question. And of course, children come to us at our FASD assessment clinic with an alphabet of diagnoses, ADD, ODD, etc., ASD. The answer really is that children with a brain injury may have any of those diagnoses. They may have problems with attention and hyperactivity. They may have symptoms that are very consistent with autism spectrum disorder, and in fact, on formal assessment, they may actually have ASD as a result of their brain injury. So it's an interesting question. I mean, one of the things that we've postulated is that it's perhaps more acceptable to have a diagnosis of ASD in a middle-class educated family than not. And also that we're concerned that perhaps conditions such as ASD have been used as a diagnosis to assist a family in getting financial and other supports from government. Because up until recently, FASD hasn't been recognised as warranting such support. So, look, I think it's an interesting question, and we need to be open-minded. We often diagnose ASD, ADHD, and other disorders in these children.
Thanks, Liz. And while I've got you, Lauren has asked a question. She's really, as a couple of our other participants are interested in it, how possible is it? What are the chances for children who are experiencing FASD to excel or to do quite well in schooling and other systems?
Look, that's a very interesting question, and it is very important for us to identify children's strengths. So we know, for example, some children are very good at art, some are very good at sport, some are musical. We know that there are children who have FASD who qualify with the criteria, but go on to have a higher education. We know that there have been sportsmen who've been had a diagnosis of FASD. And every couple of years, I go to a conference in Canada where we meet with families and children and now adults with FASD. And some of those adults are doing very well. For example, one who presented at the conference this year has his own child, is married, and has a very lucrative business as a speaker, talking about his experience with FASD. Of course, he needs someone to help monitor his appointments, monitor his finances, etc. Similarly, in the Aboriginal communities in which I work in Fitzroy Crossing, there are a couple of boys who have been successful in having their own businesses, lawn mowing, gardening businesses. But again, with that external brain, with the assistance of a carer or a parent who is able to guide them in driving, for example, some of them can't drive, in managing their finances, in managing their appointments, and in getting to a place, the right place on time.
Great. Thank you, Liz. Sarah, I'm going to move to you next because Courtney's asked a really great question around have there been advances, or is it now possible to diagnose children with FASD at an earlier age?
Sorry, I wonder if that's a question for Elizabeth, but I think as a psychologist, I could just say very quickly from a psychology perspective, certainly some of the things that a psychologist would manage or support a family with wouldn't necessarily be evident before the age of 6, 7, 8, when we start to get that discrepancy between in executive functioning really showing up. So, but Elizabeth's probably a better person to speak about diagnosis because she's diagnosing all the time.
Yeah, thanks, Sarah. Liz, do you have a thought on that?
Well, look, it's certainly possible to recognise children who are at high risk, even at birth. So we often have, we know that the mother has drunk excessively during the pregnancy. The baby might be born irritable, small, for dates, preterm, and have characteristic facial features. They may have other birth defects. It's very difficult to make the diagnosis unless you've got the three facial features, a small head circumference at birth, and then you would go on in infancy to watch that child and to do developmental assessments, formal assessments using a Griffiths or a Bayley's, until you were sure that you the child had global developmental delay in addition to prenatal alcohol exposure and the physical features. As Sarah said, most commonly children will present at about 6 or 7 or 8, often with behavioural problems, often with learning problems, when increasingly they're struggling to keep up with their peers at school, and increasingly their parents are struggling with some challenging behaviours at home.
Great. Thank you, Liz and Sarah. Sarah, there's lots of questions coming in to our chat room around how FASD affects children at different stages of their life, and you and Liz started to answer that then, but I wonder if you could just maybe elaborate on that a little bit.
Sure. So I think as we've heard from everyone tonight, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder can look differently for each child, and notwithstanding those, you know, those domains of cognitive impairment, neurocognitive impairment that Elizabeth has outlined in the diagnostic criteria. So it looks different for each child, but what is a consistent theme is that you could expect that dismaturity, like Sue said, the difference, the gap between what their same age peers are doing and how they're achieving, how they're relating, and what's happening for that child. As an infant, you may or may not see low birth weight, low head circumference, difficulties with sleeping and settling. As a toddler, you may, and as a preschooler, you may start to see more social difficulties. And then as you enter the the school age, you start to get that gap kind of widening, and you start to see, because of the kids start to fall behind, you know, generally in language and executive functioning and memory and all those kind of skills that they need to draw on in a classroom, in a rapidly changing classroom environment. And so the task of childhood, you know, they start to fall behind in those tasks of childhood. And then as they enter into adolescence, they sort of fall behind in those tasks of adolescence that we're expecting an adolescent to become increasingly independent, to start managing their own time a little bit more, you know, managing money, maybe getting a job, having a wider social network. And kids start to fall behind in all those things because of their neurocognitive sort of challenges. And so, you know, at each stage of the life journey, if you like, you can see that they're kind of struggling to, there's a widening gap between them and their same age peers. And that's kind of what Sue was talking about in that kind of dismaturity. It's like that's what their developmental level is a little bit behind in some or many features of their development compared to their same age peers.
Thanks, Sarah.
Does that answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it does. So I want to ask you a little bit about your experience with service providers. And what are the most important aspects, do you think, of service provision that helps families living with FASD?
I'd have to say the first thing is to listen to and include parents and carers, because really who knows their child better than they do and who holds the child's interest closest to their heart? This also means that sometimes confidentiality isn't always in the best interest of the child or adult who has FASD. It's really important that service providers recognise it's a brain-based disability that has far-reaching lifelong impacts, and services need to be long-term, and quite often services aren't long-term. They're sort of a block of however many weeks. And accommodations need to be provided for the person with FASD, just as we provide accommodations for, you know, those other more visible disabilities. And it's really important that they need to be aware that to achieve positive outcomes, the programs and the service providers are the ones that will need to make changes rather than the person with FASD. I think that's about it.
Yeah, thanks for that, Sue. And in your own experience, what are some of the strategies that you have used to ensure your child has been included in education and community services?
Advocacy, 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 persistence, persistence, persistence. And being prepared to provide education and resources to anyone who's been involved with working with our daughter. The most important strategies that help her now as an adult have been ensuring that she has stable accommodation, and through the NDIS advocating for adequate funding to provide her with daily support. So through that funding, we've managed to secure a service provider organisation who provide daily support workers who help her with money management, making and keeping appointments, shopping, healthy eating, involvement in community activities and mentoring to help her make safe choices. And we realise she'll need that lifelong. It's not something that she's probably going to learn and be able to do. She does really well when those supports are in place, but if you remove those supports, you go right back to square one.
Yeah, thank you, Sue. Sarah, I've got a question here from Manusha, who's asked us if we suspect that a child might have FASD, how do we go about getting a diagnosis?
I would refer the question to, I would advise people to get in touch with the FASD Hub, which is, you can just Google, and it has all the information about diagnostic clinics, service providers, people who work with FASD. So I think that's a really good place. And the other place is NoFASD Australia, which is the kind of peak support group for parents and families living with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So these That'll be your first point of contact to connect you with a diagnostic clinic. And in most jurisdictions, there is some form of diagnostic clinic now. But Elizabeth might be able to give us more details about that.
Yes, I mean, I agree, Sarah, that the Hub and the NoFASD website both offer great supports. There are a few specialised FASD assessment clinics, one in New South Wales at the Children's Hospital at Westmead, one on the Gold Coast, another one up in Queensland. There's a private clinic service called Patches Paediatrics, particularly in Western Australia. And there's recently been a clinic opened at Monash University. But I guess I want to emphasise that for the health professionals who are online, we don't need hundreds of specialised fetal alcohol spectrum disorder assessment clinics, although it's extremely helpful for them to be a resource for training other health professionals for providing diagnoses and for assisting in research. However, any child development service, any general paediatrician, any community paediatrician, developmental paediatrician, this should really be core business. And I think the important thing is that if you have a child with neurodevelopmental impairment, if you see a child who's struggling at school, if you know that a mother has used alcohol in pregnancy, just ask the question, could this be fetal alcohol spectrum disorder? And what can I do as my bit to move this along? So it might be, as a midwife, asking the questions about alcohol in pregnancy, as a child health nurse, documenting growth and head circumference, and then as a paediatrician, going systematically to the guide to the diagnosis and saying, how do I need to get this child assessed? What are the main concerns for the mother and the school? Are they language and communication? Should I get a speech therapy assessment? Are they motor skills? Should I get an OT or physio assessment? And then piecing those bits of information together to make a diagnosis, and if in doubt, to refer to one of the specialised services that can provide guidance, if not by assessing that child, but to you personally about how to proceed with a particular child. I talk about children because I'm a paediatrician, but of course this is a diagnosis that can and should be made in adolescents and adults. In Australia, there's really a great dearth of services, professionals who feel competent and capable to consider and make that diagnosis. But increasingly, we're making it in adolescent children with the help of our neuropsychologists and our multidisciplinary team.
Thanks for that, Liz. I've got a really great question for you from Kate, who asks, the biggest challenge that she is facing is how to talk to mothers and practical ways to actually bring this topic up. She says she likes what you've said about being non-judgmental, but are there any other practical ways to be able to bring this up with mothers?
Well, look, it's obviously very dependent upon the phase of life, and I think it's really important that any primary health carers or people who deal with young women raise this issue well before they get pregnant. And many of our young women are drinking and binge drinking regularly. If they are binge drinking, or if they want to keep drinking at high levels, then they should be advised to use contraception. They should also be advised that if they're planning a pregnancy or want to get pregnant, then that's the time to give up the grog and give up, stop their contraception. Speaking, obviously, to a biological mother is very different to speaking to a foster mum. And I did mention that in my Sydney clinic, a lot of the mums we see are foster or adoptive mums. And often it's very difficult to get the information about alcohol exposure, so we have to go back to records. With regard to dealing with young mums and biological mums particularly, I think we need to broach this in as sensitive a way as possible as part of investigating the pregnancy as a whole. So we often say that these are the questions that we ask every woman who comes to the clinic, that we want to know about their diet in pregnancy, their exercise level, whether they smoked, whether they used prescription drugs, whether they took alcohol. And I guess the important thing, if we're really looking ultimately to, if we're really suspecting a diagnosis or indeed want to progress towards a diagnosis, it's very important that we ask the questions in a meaningful way. And we use the Audit C, three questions. How often did you drink alcohol during the pregnancy? On an occasion, how many drinks did you usually have? And how often did you drink more than five drinks on one occasion? You know, often you won't want to ask that question when you first meet a mother, but as you build trust in that relationship and they come back to see you again, you may be able to broach the topic.
Thanks so much, Liz. So lots of feedback on our chat room around the first-hand knowledge that you have to offer us. Could you talk a little bit about the professionals in your life that have helped you and your daughter the most? And what was it about them specifically that was so helpful?
Okay, I have to say that unfortunately every professional that I've seen first up has not had very great knowledge about FASD. So the ones that have been really helpful are the ones who've not only been willing to listen to me and value the knowledge I have about my daughter, but those that have been willing to upskill themselves and educate themselves about FASD. So if I see a professional and they're not willing to do that, and I can tell straight away whether they really do understand FASD or not, if they're not willing to upskill themselves, I find another professional. So parents have a saying, I guess, that knowing about FASD isn't the same as truly understanding FASD. And a FASD-informed professional recognises that they need to, and I think I said this earlier, have, if they're going to achieve any positive outcomes, they need to change what they do in their program rather than the person with FASD changing. So my dream is that in the future, there's lots of FASD-informed professionals who truly understand FASD and will one day be the providers of information to parents and carers rather than the other way around, which unfortunately for many parents and carers is still a situation.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that, Sue. Sarah, a question for you. Do you have any strategies or resources around supporting the inclusion of the child within a kindergarten or classroom environment?
Yeah, I can talk about some general strategies, but just before I do that, I just wanted to pick up on both what Sue and Elizabeth have said about children in the foster care system, and I think we've kind of touched on it, but I think it's really, I just want to emphasise how critical it is for workers who are working with families to record that alcohol and drug consumption if they, you know, possibly can, because it's not uncommon for, it's very difficult to for a child who's in the foster care system to get that information retrospectively. So I just wanted to take the opportunity to emphasise that as part of a social work practice, that I'd really like to see a lot more emphasis on that kind of history taking and recording it in the system. So strategies for the classroom. So basically, picking up on Sue's point about, you know, we need to change what we're doing rather than expecting the young person to change. I think that applies to a classroom setting as well. We're looking for kind of universal strategies that we can use, that a teacher can adopt, that's going to support the child living with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, but not impact negatively on other children as well. So the kind of universal strategies we're looking at is creating, like Sue said, a low sensory, low distraction environment. So it might be about seating children, you know, strategically. We, you know, sometimes use opaque contact on the windows to avoid distractions, avoiding fluorescent lighting, that sort of stuff. So we're trying to create a low stimulus environment, which is often contrary to how teachers like to set up their classroom, because they like to show how busy the classroom's been and what they've been achieving. So that's sort of something to consider. Something that also can be helpful is to build sensory strategies throughout the day, particularly lots of big muscle group breaks, squats and, you know, star jumps, the seated sit-ups, things like that can be helpful. These are things that all the kids can do, and they're not sort of singling out kids living with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Yeah, so basically setting up, simplifying the classroom, changing our expectations, understanding that it's a brain-based condition, that we need to do things differently, not the child, and simplifying our interactions with kids, you know, really keeping our sentences nice and short, maybe 5 words, simple instructions, no complex or abstract concepts. If you want to teach those, you'll need to do those very visually with lots of mind mapping. So adopting strategies that those are the kind of strategies that you can adopt to all children. It's not going to impact on their learning, but it's also going to be very supportive for kids living with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and also explicitly teaching self-regulation skills. So a lot of classrooms are doing mindfulness now, which is great, but also there are some physical strategies that you can teach children, because not all children are, you know, engaged with mindfulness. Although it's a very evidence-based approach, some physical means of release too, or, you know, just offering a variety of means for self-regulation, but also explicitly target self-regulation as a skill for all kids. I think those kind of approaches are useful.
Thank you so much, Sarah. I've got time for one more very quick question. Which I'll ask you, Liz, because we've had a couple of questions on this, and Amy's is one of them. So what level of alcohol consumption during pregnancy is likely to lead to fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, do you think?
Look, that's the million-dollar question, and it's the question that I'm most often asked. In fact, I'm most often asked, how much is it safe to drink? Now, we know that the more you drink, the more likely you are to do harm to the baby. But the harm to the unborn child is very variable, and it depends on a number of different factors. First of all, Sarah and I might drink the same amount of wine. I might be older, have different liver function, different genes for metabolizing alcohol. I might have pre-existing medical problems. I might have different liver function, and hence my peak blood alcohol level, which is then transmitted to the unborn child, might be significantly higher than Sarah's. So the amount that you drink on occasion is important. The timing is absolutely critical. So we know that the facial features that are so characteristic might develop within a 3 to 4 day period in embryology. The heart develops at another time, the kidneys at another time. So timing is really important. We think that binge drinking is particularly damaging, again, because you get that high blood alcohol level. And I think I just want to emphasize at this point that drinking throughout the pregnancy can be harmful. So even in the very end of the third trimester at pregnancy, we're getting continued rapid growth of the brain, increasing connections between the hemispheres. So I guess I'm not sure that I've exactly answered your question. It's very variable. It's dependent on very many different factors, including, which I didn't mention, fetal genetics. And so it's very difficult to predict the risk in the individual pregnancy. And our strategy as clinicians and as public health physicians is really to take a precautionary approach and to advise women that the safest option, at least to prevent fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and the many other harms that we know occur with alcohol, the safest option is to avoid alcohol during the pregnancy and in the planning period. The other issue, I guess, to say is that as diagnostic testing, such as 3D facial imaging and functional imaging of the brain, get more sophisticated, as we're able to look at epigenetic changes in response to alcohol, we're realizing that alcohol may do a lot of unseen harms, things that are not evident at the clinical level. Increasingly, I think that we'll realize that probably it's best to avoid alcohol altogether in the months, the 3 months or so before pregnancy, during pregnancy, and indeed during breastfeeding.
Thank you so much, Liz. And again, thank you to all our presenters tonight and our participants who have sent in hundreds of really great questions, which we're not going to get time to answer tonight, but really pleased to begin the conversation with you all tonight. And we certainly hope that it's an ongoing conversation, because the questions and the content tonight have been really interesting and very important, I think. So what I'm going to do now is just ask our three panellists just for one quick final observation on the topic. So I'll start with you, Liz.
Well, look, as a paediatrician, I'd have to emphasise that fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is potentially preventable. We need to do everything as we can as clinicians to try and assist women not to drink during pregnancy. And I think we also need to advocate to our government to do the things that we know will prevent harm from alcohol, whether it be to ourselves or to the unborn child, and that is by restricting access to alcohol through pricing and taxation, through opening hours, through the number of liquor outlets, and to try and prevent advertising and promotion of alcohol, particularly to our children, who by the time they're 10 or 11 are really au fait with alcohol brands, thanks often to our sportsmen and women. Thank you.
Thanks, Liz. Sarah.
Yes, thanks. I guess I would like to just finally emphasise that for the psychologists listening, that you probably already have some skills that you can bring to bear to support families who are living with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. But I would also encourage you to read, visit the FASD Hub and NOFASD Australia, and listen to foster carers and family, because even the scientific knowledge around what fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is rapidly evolving. And so just because it's not written about yet doesn't mean it's not real for that family. So I'd just encourage you that you have some skills already that you can offer. I'd encourage you to read and learn more, but also really have an open mindset around this condition, and be willing to learn and listen.
Thanks, Sarah. Sue, I'll finish with you.
Okay. My biggest wish is, and I'm really thrilled that there's so many people that have dialed in tonight to listen to the webinar, and parents and carers need FASD informed professionals. So you've taken the first step, and I'd just like to encourage everybody that's listened tonight to learn more and be there for parents and carers, so we have far more FASD informed professionals out there. That's what parents and carers are wanting and asking for. Thanks everybody for being there tonight for tonight's webinar.
Thanks so much to Sue and to Liz and Sarah, and thanks to the 608 of you who've joined us throughout tonight's activities. Really great content, great questions, and it's been a really interesting night. Just to let you know that for resources and further reading, other supporting resources associated with this webinar can be found by clicking on the light blue screen, light blue supporting resources icon. And for more information about Emerging Minds, please visit our website on www.emergingminds.com.au. So thank you for participating tonight. Please ensure you complete the feedback survey before you log out.